Welcome to From the Chaowel to the Yangtze, the Oxford China Center podcast, where current students interview China Center alumni about their professional journey and experiences with China. I'm Sahil, a third-year sinologist at University College.
And I'm Thomas, a second-year sinologist at University College. And today we're going to be speaking to Cindy Yu, a current broadcaster at The Spectator. Cindy, thank you so much for being with us today. Can you give us a brief overview of exactly what you studied at Oxford? We know you didn't start off at the China Center as an undergrad.
Yeah, that's right. I joined Oxford for my undergraduate degree, and that was in PPE. And then afterwards, I didn't find a job, so I just did a master's at the China Center, and that was Contemporary Chinese Studies. It's a one-year MSc, so that was a really fun year.
And can we ask, what's your favourite memory from Oxford, just to get the ball rolling?
Yeah, of course. Well, I think I've been thinking about this, and I know to be on brand, I should pick something to do with the China Center. But I actually have to say, one of my best memories from Oxford, and you know, maybe best night of my life, was actually our third year graduation ball. I was at Christchurch, and the commemoration ball there really goes quite large, and there was an ABBA, you know, there was an ABBA band, not the actual ABBA, but just the band, what's the word, trying to, you know, reenacting them, and, you know, lots of different fun things, and it was just the perfect night to say goodbye to your undergraduate friends and start the new chapter in your life.
Oh, sounds so much fun. We need tribute ABBA bands back in our lives, but Corona allowing.
Yeah, certainly that way. So how did you end up choosing the master's at the China Center, and how do you think your interest in China came about?
It's quite a roundabout way, actually. I'm Chinese myself. I was born in China, but I've lived in the UK for many years. I was a child when I moved here. But I actually didn't really have an interest in China until I started thinking about applying for the master's. And the reason I did was actually because of Roads Must Fall, which I know is still a big movement in Oxford at the moment. But when I was there, I was first started getting kicked off. And one of the things I found most persuasive about the campaign was the need to decolonize curriculums. And I just thought, you know, so much of my PPE curriculum was white men from Europe. And I had no idea anything about the, you know, the rest of the world and the philosophical tradition they come from, the political histories that they have. So then I thought, you know, why not study China in a bit more detail? And that's really what got me into it. I was actually aiming for more Chinese philosophy in my in doing my master's. But the way things turned out, I actually found more of the contemporary stuff much more interesting, so the politics. And I did my dissertation on modern Chinese youth opinion, so whether or not propaganda campaigns in schools really work. And that I just found that so fascinating. So yeah.
And did you ever experience any of that political education while you were in China, or did you leave long before having any schooling in China itself?
No, I definitely did. I actually found the other day my red neckerchief, which, you know, all school students in China have to wear because red to symbolize socialism. I just found that and I just moved it to London with me for some reason, no idea why, but it brought back a lot of memories. But yeah, I was in school in China until about year three. So there was a lot of flag raising, there was a lot of national anthem singing. There was not too much like political ideology. I think it would be a brave person to try to explain Marxism to an eight-year-old. But I, yeah, there was certainly a little bit of the sort of, at least the performative side of things.
Did you find when you started doing your master's that a lot of memories you hadn't processed once you came to the UK and like had stopped being so interested in China came back to the fore?
Yeah, I think definitely having that experience growing up in China changes how you do China watching. Not everyone in my class was from China, although there were a few. And I think it's just interesting to have that firsthand experience when you're talking about these things to really be able to kind of root it in the memory. But the whole, my dissertation was more on kind of secondary school, university education. I didn't experience that. And actually, it gave me a good chance to meet people my age in China when I interviewed them about my dissertation and kind of see the kind of education I missed out on. Because I love philosophy and politics, and that's why I did PPE. But I don't think I would have loved it if I had stayed in China, because philosophy and politics there is just rote learning, party mandates and all that sort of stuff are just incredibly dry and boring. But it is good to have that comparison.
Yeah, I completely get that. Do you think that this upbringing and cultural background surrounding China influences you as a journalist? I mean, perhaps compared to other journalists when you report on this area, and do you think it influences how you present China compared to them? Obviously, many journalists reporting on China today do not have such a connection with the country themselves.
I think I constantly have to check my assumptions in a way that other people don't. I got into a debate with my editor recently about whether or not China's history really was that glorious. And I couldn't tell where my education ended and where my critical thinking began, because I was, you know, all very much like, you know, until the late Qing Dynasty, China was a great empire, all this sort of stuff. And then I thought, actually, I don't really know that much about Chinese history. And, you know, he was all saying, you know, per capita, were people really wealthy in China compared to other civilizations? I didn't know that. And a lot of my preconceptions definitely do come from my schooling and also Chinese historical dramas. But in more generally, I think having that experience of China really helps me in my journalism, because I can ground things. And I try to, and I think this is very little done in the West for now, but I would like to be someone who can explain the Chinese perspective on things, because we hear the Western perspective all the time on various controversial issues. What I think we hear less is why China as a country functions, if it is the case that its 1.4 billion people are incredibly oppressed, if it is the case that no other religion other than, you know, no religion actually is able to manifest there, if it is the case that all Hong Kongers hate the government, you know, how does that country function? And clearly there are nuances there that talking to Chinese people, whether it's my friends and family or people that I interview, really brings that out in a way that, you know, as an outside observer, you don't really see the same way.
And what would you say some of your findings about how a country like that does function, given that, yeah, like you said, in a Western perspective, we're like counting down the days until 1.4 billion rise up and that day never seems to come. And what would you say sort of chatting to people has made you feel about why they don't do that and how their system does work?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, I mean, I think there are a lot of answers to that question, but I think the biggest thing is how much China has changed in the last four decades since reform and opening, and how much that weighs upon people's consciousness, in that, you know, it really does change how you see a government if you associate them with that success, which is not just material, it's so material that it's moral, it is lives extended, it is children that you can never have had. You know, one child policy aside, but, you know, it's a much better standard of living. And so people in the West don't understand why Chinese people don't rise up against the government, why some Hong Kongers actually are against the protests, for example. And I think people in the West come from a very privileged background where they've never had to worry about that. Their parents are probably very well off already, or maybe even better off than, you know, millennials are today. But China's gone a completely reverse direction. So that economic transition, I'm not saying this gratitude is well placed or not, but I think that really changes a people's perspective. And so a lot of Chinese people I see, you know, you should ask them about political issues, and part of it will be their upbringing, but also partly they'll be like, well, you know, why should we care about these political problems? Why should we care about political rights when we've got our Tiananmen, when we've got our rice bowls, you know, at the ready? So I think that's something that you know, people from countries that are more wealthy find hard to understand why people who are in poorer countries might make some of those trade-offs.
Mm. Well, do you think there's a pressure to almost change your views to what Western readers would like to read, or Western listeners would like to listen to in the form of news about China? Because it sounds as though you're trying to present sort of a completely different story to what they'll understand a lot of the time.
Yeah, it is a balance to be struck, and I'm very grateful to be at the Spectator because this is a very good place to find that balance. Talking to my colleagues who have completely different views on China, for example, some of them, others agree with me on a lot. That's a really good discursive process to really understand, you know, where my assumptions lie, where I'm more justified in thinking the things I do think, and also, you know, completely different ways of thinking things that in your writing, as you say, Thomas, you do have to reflect because everyone's entitled to their opinions. So you gotta reflect that. For example, my piece recently was my latest piece was on vaccine diplomacy and how China is exporting its vaccines globally as a soft power measure. And the reaction I got from some people was, that's ridiculous. They're the ones who spread this virus around. It's something that never even occurred to me, you know, that sort of, I mean, obviously I know that, but it's something that never even occurred to me as relevant to my argument. But, you know, having that reaction meant, oh yes, a lot of readers will think it's weird if I don't mention that. So that process is really helpful in journalism to have that bounce back. So yeah, I think it's a good thing that I'm checked on certain things.
But to pivot back to the China Center, we've talked a lot about how your childhood and background inform your work now. I was wondering, what about the course at the China Center? Does that continue to inform? We've talked about your thesis. Does the course as a whole, do you think, help you in your work with China today?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm not just saying this because Todd Hall or Rana Mitter might be listening, but because, you know, it was such a good overview of a lot of topics that I never knew about. I think before I did my course, my knowledge of China was very informal. I didn't know much really other than my anecdotal experience growing up, leading to assumptions like, you know, all these dynasties were really wealthy, but not thinking about the peasants or whatever it is. But the course, what it did was gave me a very structured overview of the most important topics in China studies today. So now I feel like I'm able to have a good basis if I want to go into a particular new topic, for example, China and Africa, which I've not looked at too much, but I have, you know, I did so much about it in my course that I feel like I wouldn't be daunted in finding out more about it. And I'd know what to look for in the tensions then, who to read and that sort of stuff. So I think the course, giving that structure and giving that overview was really, really helpful.
Yeah, I can see how that sets up a good springboard for going into a career dealing with China afterwards. That said, how did you arrive where you are at the Spectator? I saw on your CV that you did political risk analysis. Is that correct?
Yeah, so after I graduated, I was quite, you know, applying for jobs in final year was quite tough. And I was kind of disillusioned. So I went on to the Times Graduate Guide and I went to the income panel and I filtered the results top to bottom because I was just kind of disillusioned. I was like, I tried to apply for the Spectator and I didn't get the job at that time. So I was like, well, I'll just find a good high paying job. And then actually, funnily enough, the Lidl graduate scheme for the supermarket came up pretty high. So I was like, okay, I'll give that a go. I'm pretty organized. People clearly make it to the top of retail and it's not like their passion is apples and oranges or anything like that. So people clearly do it. And so I somehow did half a year of the Lidl graduate scheme. But during that time, I felt like my mind just wasn't being exercised at all because I was just literally stacking shelves. So that was when I, you know, looked for more things to do with my studies. I looked at Project Syndicate, which is a website that's a lot of it is crowdsourced from kind of analysts from across the world talking about various geopolitical and international issues. So I filed a few pieces to them, and that was really interesting. At the same time, I filed a few more pieces to the Spectator, and then, you know, the stars kind of aligned. And there was a vacancy at the Specky. So I just took it basically and I quit Lidl after 6 months. And I've just been here since then. So it's almost all I know in my working life, the Spectator.
And would you say now that you're doing a lot of podcasts, and in particular, I guess, with China, the Chinese Whispers podcast, would you say you have a favorite one that you've done so far? Or, I mean, is it generally just always a great experience?
No, definitely. And I won't say which ones, but definitely there are some episodes you're like, oh, that wasn't my finest. But yeah, I'm fascinated with identity. So the ones I've done on identity, I've loved. And that has, so the two of them are Hong Kong identity, how that's formed with Professor Stephen Tan from SOAS. That was really fascinating, just because he's a Hong Konger, just talking about how the city kind of gradually deviated from the mainland in its identity. And to hear him talk about his experiences in 70s Hong Kong, going to the mainland for the first time as a teenager and coming back to Hong Kong, that was just incredible and it was so interesting. And then another one I did was about the Uyghurs, and it was more about, and it was about Han identity as opposed to other ethnic minorities in China, and the political dimensions of even just categorizing these minorities in the sort of Communist Party way. And that was really chewy and interesting. That went on for an hour by accident, but I thought it was really interesting, so I released everything. But yeah, so all these notions about ethnicity, identity, I think those are my favorite episodes to do.
That's a really interesting take on it. I suppose you can really get under the skin on those areas with chatting to academics from the region. After the pandemic, is there a place that you would ideally like to report from? For instance, China.
Oh, you know, I'd love to. I just don't know how it would work. As I've said, I started China reporting from London. And I go back to China a lot when it's not pandemic times. I probably go back once or twice a year. But I don't know if I could base my journalism there for all sorts of very boring reasons, like I'd have to find somewhere other than a spectator to work because they probably can't fund me full time, to having, you know, family and a partner in London and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, theoretically, yes, I would love to live in China again. I'm always wowed by the progress and the ease of living in China there is. I don't know how much more complicated that would be if I was to writing politically sensitive things from the heart of Shanghai or Beijing. I can imagine that could complicate things.
Is there somewhere you'd like to go on a spectator, like reporting trip to, you know, just for a couple of days?
Yeah, actually, I'd love to go to Xinjiang. I don't know if I could go, but I would just love to know what's going on there, because you hear so much and there are so much studies and satellite photos and whatever it is. And I've never been to the region because I'm from Nanjing, which is literally on the other side of the country. So I would just love to know what it's like to walk through the streets there, because I think a lot of the people who talk about it have their perspective. And I've talked to Chinese friends and family who've been there as well, and they're going to have their own perspective. So I would just like to just experience it for myself, and just talk to some people by myself. But I don't think that's going to, I think that'll be very difficult to happen. So a slightly less ambitious place on the wish list would probably be Shenzhen. And this is something my editor and I were talking about before the pandemic, to go to the Huawei campus. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but they've got literally like mini cities in like an inter-campus train that goes, takes them from various campuses on site, all for Huawei. And it's like Silicon Valley gone mad. So I'd love to see what that city is like.
For Xinjiang, it just made me think of, there have been a couple of BBC journalists that were given, you know, special access to the camps. I guess it was about a year ago, you know, in a way to try and sort of legitimize what the regime was doing. Mm. Obviously, they still filed critical reports. I don't know how, it made me wonder, is there a sort of community among kind of British, Western, China reporting journalists? Sort of, have you spoken to any of those journalists that have been there and kind of heard about their experiences, or is actually the profession still quite organization driven?
Not too many British journalists do China in that great depth, actually. I find that when I'm looking for guests for my podcast, for example, a lot of them are Americans, which is understandable. I think that on the second part of your question, which is just about people who've been to Xinjiang, the professor I spoke to for my Xinjiang episode, James Millward, he's a, you know, decade-long China Xinjiang expert, and he's kind of, I mean, he's had trouble with getting his visa approved to go there since a book he wrote 10 years or so ago. So this is the problem, right? This is the problem with reporting on China. If the Chinese Communist Party wants there to be sort of legitimizing activities from fair reporting, they need to let more reporters and academics in to know what's going on. Otherwise, who knows what's going on? And you're reduced to firsthand accounts and satellite photos. I've gone completely off topic, but yes, I have spoken to people who've been there and a lot of them say similar things. But you know, I mentioned family and friends. I do know someone who was born in Xinjiang. She's ethnically Han. And even reading between the lines of what she says, you know, there are certain things she doesn't think are a problem, but you would think actually that is a red flag. For example, fewer words like halal Xinjiang are being seen on the streets of Xinjiang. Like that sort of stuff, being Han, it doesn't bother her, but clearly it speaks to something underneath.
Yeah, absolutely. It's seeing the cultural shift on the sort of personal level is just, well, really profound, especially compared to the grand statistics. But speaking of being a journalist in China and the sensitivities that it brings, do you feel any nervousness towards covering politically poignant issues like such as Xinjiang and Hong Kong?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say there's two sorts of nervousness. One sort is political, that, you know, when the national security, no, it can't be national security law. When I was going past Hong Kong, I think in 2019, yeah, I was on Twitter and I was very conscious that maybe I shouldn't be tweeting while I'm just literally going to do a changeover in Hong Kong airport. So that sort of nervousness does exist. And I think, at the moment, I don't think I'm, you know, a renowned journalist on China or anything like that. I'm not big enough fish for any trouble per se, but certainly I think it's at some point, you know, that is definitely clearly something that China does do. So that's one thing. And then there's also a nervousness from just being responsible in my reporting, which is just that, you know, I don't want to display Chinese people as apologists for the regime because I don't think they are. I don't want to display them as brainwashed because I don't think they are. So finding that balance between what parts of the regime they do accept and what parts they don't, and accepting that and just always responsibly portraying that, I find that quite nerve-wracking, actually. Just in my pieces, I always have to reread, like, am I simplifying the people that I've talked to? Am I misunderstanding their perspectives? Or am I being too charitable? And maybe they are just being, you know, ridiculous or too red, as we would say, in their way of thinking. Just having that responsible reporting, because I think it's such an important thing for the West to understand China. And I just hope I don't contribute to any misunderstandings. So that's nerve-wracking.
I think that's a really important point. It's quite easy to paint 1.4 billion people with quite a broad brush. But in terms of reporting, do you aim to take on a wide subject areas or more biographical and day-to-day reporting? You can really get a bit more nuance from focusing on the views of individuals?
Sure. It's a good question. I think a bit of both is needed. And I think I've done both. You know, I've done small stories like marriage markets around China and went to one in Shanghai. And that was very much about people's lives. That then I chucked a bit of, you know, macro trends. What does this say about the sex ratio imbalance, for example? What does this say about gender dimensions? That sort of stuff. But I've also done really macro pieces like this vaccine diplomacy one, where, you know, individuals involved weren't really the most interesting part, or at least not the grassroots individuals, the individual presidents and stuff I quote, and they're very interesting. But so a bit of both, I think, and depends on the story.
Yeah.
Can I ask, going forward again, what are your, we've talked a lot, I guess, about the sensitivities of the emerging sort of Chinese consciousness and our awareness of them as like this political force that we should like take seriously in the West and not just reduce to being, you know, brainwashed sort of subjects of the Communist Party. But increasingly, it is more possible to have quite a polarized discourse about China in China and in the West. And so I was kind of wondering whether you feel the macro trends are going to allow for more reporting like yours, which is looking to take a sort of humanistic approach to both sides, and then kind of, sorry, more generally pivoting onto the future of Sino-Western relations. If you feel that they are just on a downward trend, there obviously are going to be individuals like you who are seeking to avoid that polarization. But maybe in general, do you feel, unfortunately, there's an unavoidable trend downwards?
I think it's a double-edged sword. I'm not complaining about it because it comes with everyone being so interested in China. That's the reason for the polarization. It's because China's under more scrutiny. So in a way, it makes this a really exciting time to be a China journalist because people are interested in what you have to say. And you hear all the time about international journalists doing really important stories that they care so much about, but no one cares about the country that they're reporting on. So I don't have that problem. But I totally see what you're saying. And certainly, you know, again, this goes back to checking myself. I have to think about my assumptions and really read widely to understand an issue in order to be able to back myself if I'm going to get backlash from either side, really. So as long as I feel like I've reported fairly, responsibly, accurately, I think all journalists probably have to kind of accept that you will have critics and just kind of, you know, brush it off. So I think as long as I can be responsible and do good journalism that I deem quality journalism and my colleagues think are good, and other things are kind of just noise. I don't know if it's going to be irrevocably downhill from here. I hope not, but I think that, you know, to use a very PPE analysis, when I did international relations in my undergraduate degree, you know, obviously one of the key schools was realism, and I think that I'm a bit of a realist when it comes to international relations, which is that power dictates great power relations. So regardless of what China is doing, given China is not the same as the West, and how much power it is getting now and how much more power it is on, you know, on the trajectory to get, I think there will be conflict between the two. Maybe not military conflict, but certainly, you know, there is going to be competition. So then that's almost inevitable. What I hope it doesn't deteriorate into is affecting people getting involved. So when I see journalists getting expelled from either side, that's very disheartening to see. When I see academics like Trump pulling the Fulbright scheme from China, that's very disheartening to see. Or indeed in the UK, so much suspicion is being chucked onto Chinese mainland students on campuses. And there's this sort of nativist idea that, you know, we shouldn't rely on foreign money and they bring all their communist ideals here. You know, that sort of stuff, I think, really just doesn't do anyone a service because there are individuals involved and no one's life is entirely political. So the people coming to this country, to give that example, are here to learn about the West. They're not here on as you know, the CCP's foot soldiers or anything like that. So I just hope that as the great powers kind of thrash this out between them, again, not necessarily militarily, I just hope that people involved are not experiencing a second McCarthyism or what Japanese Americans experienced in the Second World War, something like that. I just hope that people can separate the personal from the political, but I don't know if they can.
What would?
Sorry, go on.
No, you go.
No, I was just saying, I certainly try to pick that up whenever I see it. You know, if there's a newspaper report that kind of elides very, you know, smoothly between students and government, I'm like, well, no, that doesn't hold.
I was just going to ask about the personal and the political, what your family in China make of some of your reporting and like sort of you being a Western journalist for China and whether it feeds into your perceptions of these kind of conflicts and issues.
So yeah, it depends on who you talk to. And I think my family's kind of good cross-section. Some of them are not political at all. Some of them are very critical. One of them is a Communist Party member, but not because she believes in any of the ideology, but because they are you know, quite high up in the public sector, and that's in the sort of academic sphere. But I think you get the full gamut of opinions. And to be honest, I don't talk too much about politics with them because mainly I use WeChat to contact them, and I wouldn't want to get myself or anyone else in trouble. So a lot of the discussion is saved from when I'm actually in China and can talk to them directly. Here though, I'm with my mum and my brother, and my mum is always a great source of opinions. she's got a lot of opinions. So it's just fun to talk to people with different views and different assumptions. And just, again, it's like the reverse of what I get at work, right? It's just balancing that. And I find that really helpful to have that family. And I don't think to have that constant resource of tapping into Chinese public opinion through my family and friends, I think that's really valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see that the family is quite a good barometer for public opinion. But I suppose to wrap things up, do you have any advice for current students or China Center students, especially those looking for careers in journalism and then also careers to do with China?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think that, I mean, I would firstly say, I think I stumbled into a lot of where I am right now. So I don't think I'm in a position to be the, you know, the source of wisdom for people who don't, okay, disclaimer, don't follow this advice. But I think that, you know, when I'm in this role and I've selected interns for The Spectator, I've selected some people to be added to the podcast team. And what I see as the best applications are people who are creative and are people who take the initiative to do things. So for example, it's a bit of a trick question and hopefully no one who's applying for these jobs will listen to this. But for example, when we add people to our broadcast team, the application, we ask for no CV, we ask for aptitude tests. So you make a video, you write something, you give some suggestions for how we can grow, that sort of stuff, just to see how you would do in an actual job. The phrasing is do at least one of these tasks in the first category, and then do at least two of these tasks in the second category. The ones who tend to do the best are the ones who've done more than what people have asked for. And that's not necessarily to work hard, but just to give more of a showing off of your abilities, right? So I think a lot of people would choose the easiest tasks, the least minimal work, but actually, you know, that doesn't really set you up nicely in a very, very competitive job market, especially now post-pandemic for young people. So I would say, you know, go above and beyond and you will, you know, it might be, you know, a weekend of your life that's gone, but one of these times it'll be worth it.
Wow, yeah, that's super useful. I wonder if people are going to tune in and know the secrets of The Spectator recruitment system now. But yes, thank you so much for joining us, Cindy. It's been incredibly, incredibly informative and really insightful to hear about the nuances, I think, of being a journalist in Britain, in the West, for China, and the challenges that are going to be going forward. And thank you for everyone else who's listened in and joined us for this episode. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Be sure to subscribe to our page on Spotify or Apple Podcasts to find out as soon as our next episode is released. And yeah, thank you very much again. That's all for now.
Thanks for having me.
Great, thank you. Oh, and also our wonderful music is The Fountain of Living Waters by Siddhartha Kausas. This is licensed under the Creative Commons. The Oxford China Centre Alumni Podcast is a student-run podcast and does not necessarily represent the views of the Oxford China Centre.